For almost 2,000 years, the Catholic Church has pointed the way toward salvation through Jesus Christ. For each of us, that journey starts in darkness, as if in a cave. We invite you now to come with us as we seek wisdom and truth by way of faith and reason with your guides, Mark Tuttle and Timothy O'Donnell. Join us in the Catholic Cave. Welcome once again to the Catholic Cave. I'm Kent Blanford. In the cave with me, two of the most intelligent cave dwellers you're ever going to deal with, Mr. Mark Tuttle and Mr. Timothy O'Donnell. Gentlemen, how'd you like to have money and not have to work for it?
Free stuff. Free is the most glorious word in the English language.
It's
free.
One of my favorite four-letter words.
Yeah. I am seeing more and more in the news where at least one city in California is going to attempt, what's the term they're using?
Universal income?
Universal income.
Yeah. Ooh, doesn't that sound welcoming?
And you know, I've even heard it's being touched on in Chicago.
I might
see this in a town of 800. I don't see it in a town of 8 million. I just
don't. Yeah, and you know, it's been proposed in some of the Scandinavian countries as well. So, you know, this is an idea that's floating out there. And like a lot of economic ideas, you know, these obviously touch on human relations. They obviously touch on the common good. They obviously touch on fundamental rights. And so we as Catholics, we got to be informed as far as what our church teaches about these issues so that we can make informed decisions when these ideas get proposed.
Yeah, and I think what we're going to do today, Mark, is we're going to not tell people what to think, but hopefully what we'll be doing is bringing up relevant sort of principles from Catholic teaching to help us think through, because I think at the end of the day, there's a lot of prudential judgments that are going to need to be weighed in and defining these terms and what's really being meant.
Right. And hopefully we'll be starting a conversation, because that's ultimately what has to happen. Catholicism is very diverse, particularly when it comes to something like economics. You've got Catholic socialists. Believe it or not, you can be a Catholic socialist and still be on the reservation, so to speak. You've got hard-lined, you know, Catholic libertarians. You've got in the middle. You've got
free marketeers.
Yeah, yes. You've got distributivists. Lots of distributivists. Mm-hmm. So you've got a wide range of opinions and. All of them, as long as they adhere to fundamental Catholic principles, all of them still represent Catholic thought. And so there's got to be discussion about what's the common good. And a lot of that becomes local. You know, a lot of that becomes what's good for my principle, you know, what's good for my place, what's good for my city, what's good for my country. And what's good here may not necessarily be what's good there. So there's got to be discussion. But in order to have discussion, we've all got to be educated as far as what the church teaches and what some of the fundamental principles are.
Yep. So Kent introduced the term universal income. So maybe we start thinking about, well, what does that term mean, and what's that sort of imply? Well, and, what are they talking about?
Yeah, exactly. And it may very well mean different things in different places as well. So, you know, you've got to look through and see what's being
proposed here. It may be purposefully vague at this point on top of it.
because
it does seem to be a political issue,
right? Yeah, because, you know, right now Venezuela has universal income, and it's not looking too good.
Oh, man, they are in real trouble down there.
Now, the universal income, I think, in Venezuela is zero at the moment.
Yeah, well... So universal obviously means everyone. So it would seem that everyone would receive, as I understand it, at least generally, is I take the term universal income to mean that everyone within a particular area, whether it's a particular city or state or country, would receive from the government a monetary award to which they would apply, could spend that. With or without restrictions.
Right. And some of the different theories I've heard behind this, you know, we spend a certain amount of money on welfare programs, on programs taking care of people that are having difficulties with having employment, some of it because of disability, you know, some of it just because they can't find work. you know, we spend a certain amount of money on food stamps. We spend a certain amount of money supplementing people's income. So, you know, I think, mm-hmm. you know, wages play into this a little bit. And so the theory is, look, if we're spending X amount of money to support, you know, per capita, we can break that down and figure out, okay, we're spending, you know, $25 a day per person to support our welfare programs. Doesn't it make more sense just to give somebody $15 per day, and you know, therefore the government's saving money, we're not spending as much on the welfare programs, everybody's got this sort of subsistence level income, and then people can work and gain employment above that, and you know, then everybody's being taken care of, and we're actually saving money as a city. That's kind of one theory that's been thrown out there.
Yes, and that it could. Part of that cost saving could be there's innumerable, you know, local, state, and federal programs. So if you went to kind of, say, a single-payer system, if you will, you might be able to eliminate some of those programs, therefore save right. money. And there's just kind of I've also heard, in addition to what you said, Mark, there's a notion that it could, you know, stimulate the economy, because with everyone receiving universal income, that's money that's, since we don't save typically, that's money that's going to be spent back into the economy, and therefore there's goods that can come out of that.
Right. And in a way, there's also part of that is kind of privatizing the social service industry a little bit, trying to move away from government-sponsored social services to more of a non-for-profit social services, providing those and meeting the needs that aren't met. So this is a way for the government to kind of back out of the social service game a little bit.
Yeah, it's interesting too that in these kinds of discussions, what I find myself doing, and sometimes I've observed this in others, is we talk about government as if it's not us.
Right.
When government is actually, it is us. It is, right?
Because particularly we're in the United States.
Yeah, because
right,
we're in a democracy. Right. So the government is really, you know, by the people, for the people. So it's interesting, because when it comes down to, you know, one of the big questions would be, assuming that, you know, one's in favor of a program like that where everyone would receive, say, numbers I've heard thrown around are, you know, anywhere from like, you know, $20,000 to $30,000 to $40,000 a year, depending on where you lived, as that would just, you just receive that from the federal government. But the question is, well, where does the federal government get the money?
Right, exactly. How is this going to affect taxes? Because that tends to be where the federal government gets its money.
Or national debt, or both.
Or borrowing, exactly. Yeah, how much money are we going to be able to... And particularly when you're talking, you know, some of these propositions are coming out of the city level. You know, for the most part, a city's going to have to borrow that money, at least initially. And you know, cities have a little bit harder time keeping up credit ratings, being able to sustain a certain amount of debt than a federal government does. So, you know, that comes into play too. What's a healthy debt level for a city?
Right. And well, and does it make, I guess, and this is where, you know, it will come down to crunching some numbers, which I'd be able to do here in the cave. But it comes down to things like, you know, when we talked, you know, you talk about some of the trade-offs between the current, you know, welfare system, safety nets that are out there, and any efficiencies that might be gained by going to this universal income, and whether or not that's a net spend or a net save, and then it's how do you, and then, you know, what are your choices in terms of funding it, and who funds it, and who shoulders the burden. One of the, at the federal level, I guess, one of the concerns, so that all has to be kind of worked out before I think anyone probably could make an informed decision on whether or not it's a good approach to use. But one of the things, tidbit I would share is that I think at the federal tax level, there's about half Americans don't pay federal income tax.
Right.
And so they're right there. I guess that's a bit of a caution for me when I hear relative to universal income. Because if it's instituted at the national level, at the Fed, which would be the federal level, it's in the federal government's funding it. It seems then, you'd have potentially 100% of Americans receiving, but only 50% paying in.
Right, and that doesn't sound particularly just.
Well, but, it sounds like there could be problems. It's a flag for we need to further investigate exactly the mechanism. What sort of apparatus are we talking about erecting?
Right.
And what is this apparatus to do?
On the other hand, we've never had a system of taxes where everybody has paid in. You know, the idea that there's a magical taxation system where everyone has quote unquote skin in the game is a little bit fallacious, because when the income tax was implemented, only a very, very small percentage of the population paid in. In fact, I think the state of Georgia, when the income tax was being debated, the state of Georgia ratified and allowed the federal government to collect income tax because the income level of Georgians was low enough that nobody in the state was going to pay income taxes.
Oh, well, there you go.
So it wasn't going to blood any of their citizens, so they ratified it and said, you know what, that's fine with us. So, and property taxes as well. Property tax by no means is a universal tax. So,
sales tax is probably the closest we have.
Right, exactly.
The biggest drawback with sales tax is the minute you institute a sales tax as your major income for a government is the fact that you end up with a black market.
Oh, well, yeah. Yep. Yeah, and I'm not advocating that's what we would pivot to. I just offer that as an example of there's ways in which almost everyone is paying some form of tax, whether it's sales taxes, property taxes, state taxes.
And I think that could bring to a discussion, is that ideal? Is it ideal for everyone to be paying?
Oh, the tax on gasoline is enormous. If you're buying gas,
exactly, and that's probably pretty close to a universal tax because everybody, one way or another, is affected by that. So that one's probably close to universal tax. But once again, is that ideal? Is it ideal to have an equal tax rate across? Well, these are all what are called prudential decisions within Catholic thought. So these are all questions as what is the best way to achieve X? And X in what we're discussing is the notion of the common good. So we're going to have to take a break. When we come back, let's discuss a little bit, Tim, what we mean in Catholic thought when we're talking about the common good.
And we'll be back with more of the Catholic Cave right after this.
Most of us like to keep up on what's going on in the world and try to catch a little news each day. Did you know that you can catch the very latest Catholic news right on our website? We have news from Rome, from around the world, and here at home, updated every day so you always know what's going on from a Catholic perspective. Check it out. Go to CatholicRadioIndy.org and look for the Catholic news headlines. There's always something new at CatholicRadioIndy.org.
Welcome back to the Catholic Cave. I'm Mark Tuttle here with Timothy O'Donnell, Kent Blandford, and we are talking about proposals that have gone around for some sort of universal income. And, there's all sorts of different opinions about this, all sorts of really valid Catholic opinion about this. And so, Tim, we were throwing out some of the prudential considerations, but when you get into Catholic thought, the way a Catholic really ought to think about this is we have to come to principled opinions. Not just emotional and not just what sounds best or what makes the most sense.
Pops in my brain.
Right, exactly.
Good soundbite.
We have to base these off of Catholic principles. Yes. So one of the first ones we came across right before the break, we said, all of this should be directed towards a notion of the common good. Makes sense, but what exactly do we mean when we as Catholics talk about the common good? Because that gets lobbed around as some sort of political volleyball a lot of times, like, oh, he's not paying attention to the common good. And in some ways, it kind of loses its meaning the way it gets used.
Yeah, so I would say the common good is a reference to a community, a set of conditions that bring about human flourishing that we as a society agree upon to pursue together. So an example of, so there's a lot of features in that, and there's some room for know, variants of lists of what might be included. But basic building, these would be basic building blocks for human flourishing. So things like education would be one. We're going to pursue that would be constituent of the common good. Good order. So a society in which we would have, say, the rule of law as constituent of it, of the common good. It would also have things like pertains to what we're talking today about, relative to things like employment, work. It would also have components that would contribute to the flourishing of family life and the bringing about of and raising children. So these are the kinds of you know, it would also include other things like aesthetic experience, I would say.
Right. These are goods.
Food.
Right. These are goods that apply to everybody within your community.
Universally, yeah. Right. That we'd all universally say we would want to have both not just basic needs, but I think even, you know, predating Catholicism, Aristotle would say it's not enough just to meet basic needs. Human flourishing is you need to meet basic needs and have a little bit more.
Right. And that adds to a little bit of relativity within it, because, you know, what is going to be considered part of the common good for one community is not necessarily going to always be the common good for another community.
Exactly. And I would say even more so. So we probably, you know, we probably could, if we spent some time together, we could probably come together a pretty comprehensive list that we would generally all agree on. But within that, I think what you're also suggesting is the role of culture. So culture is going to influence also how these building blocks of the common good manifest themselves. And I would say culture is can be properly understood, at least in large part, by thinking about what are our shared values, our shared beliefs, our shared customs, and our shared institutions.
Right, and those are gonna be really defined by the community. And I think that's the first real distinction, sure, and probably place where debate's gonna take place. You know, when you're talking about something about universal income, one of the first debates that comes up is, okay, well, what are we talking about as far as universal income within which community?
It's gonna make a big difference, I mean, between, first of all, if you think about like contrasting nations, you know, universal income in the United States might, entails a whole different kind of project than, say, Bolivia.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
or, as we drill down, universal income, for, say, a very agrarian state like Nebraska is going to be very different than, say, California.
Right, right. Or even universal income for the whole state of California is going to be very different than universal income for Orange County.
Correct, yeah.
You know,
keep talking about breaking into three states now again. That's sort of come up too, which right, just kind of points to that diversity, right?
Right,
that,
exactly.
Give it time. The San Andreas fault will take care of that.
But I think one of the principles within the common good is a principle of justice, that within your community, there needs to be kind of a just distribution of these common goods. So you can't have, you know, you really within Catholic thought, there's a prohibition, but there's definitely a discouragement towards these things that are considered common to be concentrated in one small group of the population, or for one small group of the population to have access to it. For it then to be kind of distributed to everybody else or something along those lines. Things that are considered common and part of the common good for the community should be equally distributed.
Well, I don't know if I would say equally distributed. I would say maybe what we're a principle to point at would be, and maybe where you're taking us, Mark, is there's the universal destination of goods, meaning that for Catholics, we certainly affirm private property, private property rights. Even St. John Paul II, many times in various writings, has reaffirmed the necessity versus for human flourishing to rely upon private property.
That's a pretty indisputable principle of Catholic thought.
Human
beings have the right to own property.
Right. Yeah. But not without limit. So the limit comes in with the universal destination of goods, meaning that at the end of the day, even though we have private property, it's actually God's creation. And at the end, ultimately, we're stewards of the resources that that we have. And so that means that when my warehouse is full of food and you're starving, I don't have an ultimate right to, in terms of that being my private property. You starving actually have a right to some of my food.
Right. And there's it's not an absolute principle, but definitely there's a tendency within Catholic thought, I think, towards when you're talking about things that are true commons. So when you're talking about things that are kind of shared within a community, Catholic thought tends in the direction of as many people kind of being decision makers over what happens with those commons as possible, so that you don't have the situation where you've got a set of like education, for instance. The more people involved in decision making, distributing, and making available education, the better. That tends to be the tendency there.
Yeah, and I would say that's because that, or one reason why that might be the case is it the hierarchies tend towards tyranny. And despotism, if left unchecked, because we're sinful, right? And so when you diffuse power through decision making across more people, it's the centralization of power that tends to corrupt. That's Lord Acton, right? Power tends to corrupt, and ultimate power tends to corrupt ultimately, or
absolutely,
or absolutely, yeah. Yeah. So that's what we're on guard against, and. One of the phenomena that I think is, again, to keep using the word universal, I'll say universal, that I think that we can observe is that human beings in the pursuit of goods, we create unequal outcomes naturally. And the reason why we do that is that some people are simply going to be better at it than others. So if we're all practicing, say, the art of medicine, we're going to observe that just some people, some medical doctors are simply going to be better at their craft than others, and therefore are likely to garner what? Bigger rewards and benefits because of their better talents. And so I would say it's natural for us to expect unequal outcomes in the pursuit of goods, because we naturally form a kind of hierarchy, because some people are simply, for a variety of factors,
right.
some are intrinsic. In other words, people who are going to be, who are excellent at, say, sports and can make it to the professional level are going to garner wages far higher, right? The average NBA player is going to earn wages far higher than what I'm going to be able to do playing basketball.
Right. But this is also where, I think this is also where Catholic teaching pushes us towards sharing our talents, sharing our abilities, and putting ourselves at the service of humanity and the service of our communities.
Well, now that we see how unequal outcomes can happen and are bound to happen, they're inevitable, unequal outcomes, it's now what do we do with that? And I would say, Scripture gives us a lot of advice, right, and a lot of admonitions and warnings if we don't follow the advice.
Exactly.
And it's hard for the rich man to make it into heaven
because of
the responsibility that comes with having wealth or resources.
And the social teachings of the church have developed developed Scripture further. So going back and reading Rerum Novarum, reading the other encyclicals that have come on social justice kind of helps guide us a little bit in how our talents, our treasure, our blessings, how we use those really to promote the common good. But the question with the common good, I think, comes up. Philosophically, there's a notion of teleology involved in the common good. In other words, there's a trajectory that human society is supposed to be moving towards, and it's not necessarily towards more and more wealth. That's not necessarily the notion of common good. The idea of common good is sanctity. And so, where we should be moving should always be given I think, directed by the thought of what is going to be leading towards holiness for our community, not necessarily what's going to be leading towards more wealth.
Oh, I would agree with that. I was raising my eyebrow at Mark when he was saying we're not aiming at wealth. And I agree, we shouldn't aim at wealth. What I think, though, is that, or what I would offer is that I do, and I totally agree, it's holiness, it's sanctity, it's heaven. It's saving souls, our own souls first, and then the souls of as many people in our lives as we possibly can influence. But I think along the way, if we are making good prudential judgments, organizing our society the right way, prosperity at times may come along with it. And I think what we've seen, I'll point to like the last, say, 30, 40 years, we've seen the greatest lift of the poor across humanity lifted out of abject poverty ever in history. There's anywhere between close to a billion people now over the last 30, 40 years, especially across Asia, so China, India, who no longer face imminent starvation. So and there's reasons for that. And I think part of the reasons for that is that relating back to some of the principles is that we've had a certain amount of human flourishing that's occurred by unshackling human creativity, productivity, we talked a little bit about globalization. But with that, hang on, because we're going to take a quick break. You've been listening to Catholic Cave with Mark Tuttle. I'm Timothy O'Donnell, Kent Blanford. We'll be right back after this break.
Come, Holy Spirit, fill the hearts of your faithful. Have you ever wanted to discover a deeper relationship with the Holy Spirit and have your heart set on fire? Good. Then why not join us here at Catholic Radio for a DVD study series on the Holy Spirit called The Wild Goose. It's presented by Father David Pravanka, TOR, beginning September 3rd through April 3rd every other week. We will meet at 8383 Craig Street for discussion. For more information, please contact Sharon at CatholicRadioIndy.org or call 317-870-8400.
When you're tired of doing life alone, come back here. We enjoy the company. We hope you do too. Better together. Catholic Radio Indy.
Welcome back to the Catholic Cave. I'm Mark Tuttle here with Timothy O'Donnell, Kent Blanford. We're talking economics, and we started off talking about the idea of universal income. This idea that a city could save some money, particularly in the West, particularly in the United States. I guess some of the proposals have come out of Scandinavia. But the idea of universal income is that rather than providing a huge slew of social services that are expensive, you've got a bloated bureaucracy that's growing with them, we could just save money if we just made sure that everybody has a certain subsistence level income.
Like 30 grand a year.
30 grand a year, exactly. And we the government provides that, i.e. the taxpayers provide that. And right. And then, you know, we would be able to cut back on some of the bureaucracy, or we'd allow competition to rise in place. But we would ultimately be saving money by just simply cutting a check.
Or, yeah, saving money, or spending our money more wisely, could be the case too. Another way to look at it, what it avoids, though. What we haven't talked about, and I want to maybe bring this point up too, is it doesn't really address, though, the component of work and the role, the intrinsic good that work has, the context of which work provides for us to be collaborators in God's creation, and also in stewardship, and also in work is the way in which is the primary way, really, for most human beings, for us to build ourselves up, right? To engage in activities that unleash our potential. And it's through work settings that we, for example, may have our best opportunity to become virtuous.
Right.
And so a universal, so a risk or a question I have of, universal income is, does it disincentivize? Because I'd never hear work brought up in relation to it.
Right.
I hear a lot about payments going out and maybe, and it's, and to a lesser degree, like where that money's coming from. But I'm not hearing yet, maybe I'm not exposed enough to it yet, but I'm not hearing about the role, the good that work is for human beings.
Right.
And the, how that comes along with
and it. And the dignity of labor is a strong constitutive part of the church's social teachings. You read Rerum Novarum, you read the other social encyclicals, they all come back to that dignity of labor.
I'm laughing because I'm thinking of St. Paul, who said, you know, if you don't work, you don't eat.
Right, and it's true. And not only that, but, you know, our sanctity is borne out by our service to others.
Right,
and it's
right.
Very hard to serve others when you're not working.
Yourself, right.
Right, exactly. Yeah. So, you know, the way that we develop with our Christian virtue, our relationship to man, because relationships build through work as well. Right. But most importantly, the way that we serve mankind is usually through the work we do and through our vocation.
Right.
Now, you and I were talking over the break the issue of equality and yes. inequality, and all of those encyclicals come back to really admonishing against allowing huge disparities I would say of wealth, but that's really not true as far as what the encyclicals are warning against. What they're warning against are inequalities in really ownership of productive property. So in other words, inequalities in the ability to work, so at least productively.
Yes.
So, so, you know, the Rerum Novarum started off with a strong warning against capitalists to not treat their workers as simply wage slaves.
Yeah, machinery.
The machinery is just right. cogs in the industrial, you know, the industrial process. But to recognize the dignity of work and to a certain extent allow a certain amount of ownership of that labor, you know, for the laborers to sort of maintain ownership of their own labor. You know, allow them to kind of keep control over their own work.
Right. That's the and that's going to go back to, you know, the Industrial Revolution and really some of the basic principles that Adam Smith unleashed in Wealth of Nations and then which he quickly followed up, by the way, with a second very thick actually it's a 2-volume set, I think, now on his Moral Sentiments, which is sort of his book of virtues that need to accompany the Wealth of Nations, which is this. One of the most important things that Adam Smith touched on was the division of labor. But capitalism and the critique of capitalism, especially going back then, rather than being an artisan, let's say, that made shoes, and you go through an apprenticeship, you belong to a guild, and you learn how to manufacture shoes from start to finish, and that's what you did, and you sort of owned your own small shoe business, if you will. When you go into industrialization, you have that separation between you no longer, your work as a laborer isn't building towards that complete sort of crafts, becoming a complete craftsman that ultimately would sort of own one's own business, but rather you labor for wages instead. Mm-hmm. And that you only get and you're only going to learn potentially just one part. Right, of the process. That's the division of labor. It's far more, that's how you get productivity though, right? Is it's far more productive. You can make far more at far less expense by divvying up the manufacturing process
right.
into lots of little components and versus doing it start to finish yourself.
Right. And that can be demeaning. That can ultimately lead to a situation
where a kind of dehumanization.
Dehumanization, exactly, where the person is not being respected. And you know, you're no longer really treating people as ends in themselves, but now they're just simply becoming means to other ends.
Yeah, and the critique would be that you're unjust, that those in control, those say who own the industry, the factory, let's say the factory owner, could enrich themselves at the expense of the laborers, and
right.
that's what
exactly,
and that's what led to unions and strife and all of those. I will say one thing, and talk of equality. I would say, when it comes to equality, what comes to mind for me is, you know, this the absolute affirmation of the equality of the dignity of the human person, right? Regardless of age, race, creed, gender, all of that. We're all part of the same human family. But we're not going to have, again, I would say we're not going to have equal outcomes. But to your point, and what I think Holy Mother Church in her many writings and teachings is that when you begin to, let's say you're successful and you begin to amass wealth and resources and things like that, it then becomes incumbent upon you and take an, and this is a question for society at whole too, is we have to make sure that the people at the bottom, that, that these systems almost also inevitably just leave behind, that there, that we're looking at these unequal outcomes and we're finding ways to make sure that the people at the bottom are not being forgotten or trampled upon.
Right, because
and that's the poor.
Because the church is constantly reminding us that wealth and our material blessings are exactly that. These are blessings from God. You know, our wealth, our whole existence really is not us. It's not for our use, for our own aggrandizement, you know.
Yeah, our own glorification.
Exactly. You know, we are created to be stewards of what God gives us and the blessings he bestows on us. And those are really meant to be used for love of neighbor. You know, love of God and love of neighbor, not necessarily, you know, continuing to accumulate. And, you know, the Bible's full of admonitions along those lines. So Catholic social teaching is certainly a constant reminder of that, that what we have, whether it's our talents or whether it's the wealth that those talents allow us to accumulate, that is for the benefit of others.
Yes. I by no means have fully worked out. And it's really, for me, it's an open question and area of investigation that I'm interested in, I want to share, which is that in the current setting, part of what I see as sort of very different from what's come before is we have a situation where, because of technology, we can, great amounts of wealth, at least wealth on paper, can be concentrated in a few people's hands. Because of technology. So, for example, you could take like a Facebook. Well, Facebook, when you look at the wealth of like a Mark Zuckerberg, what is his wealth comprised of? His wealth is comprised of his ownership, right? Shares of Facebook, the corporation. That's a capital good. That's not like owning a fleet of cars. That's not, that can be easily, you know, that's not like having piles and piles, stacks of dollar bills in banks and things like that. It's not easy to take something like a Bezos. Bezos, the founder of Amazon, he's on track to be the first trillionaire. But what is his wealth concentrated in? It's concentrated in shares of Amazon stock. And so how do you redistribute that? Or how do you go about, you know what I mean? That's a very different setting. And that's why I think we need to continue to investigate and develop our teaching around this and our understanding, because that is that was unimaginable. And by that, that sort of setting 100 years ago, when we got Rerum Novarum,
right?
What capital wealth looked like then were in physical goods and maybe hard currency, but that's not where the wealth. And as you know, we were talking about during the break, the wealth gap continues to have between the very rich and the very poor continues to widen. But I think it's widening in large part not because of physical goods, but because you have you have electronic wealth markers that are concentrated in very few hands because of it doesn't cost anything. For example, it's almost free now to replicate many, many, many things of value because they're digitized. So in other words, if I write a song and I could have it as I could have if I write a song and someone plays and I have copyrights that song, it becomes very popular. well, how much, and it's downloaded for 99 cents right on iTunes, well, what is that? What's the cost to produce that one download? It's infinitesimal, right? So I could, if I had a hit song, maybe I might accumulate $100 million when the production cost might be as small as five people.
Right.
That took us 3 hours.
Right, right.
And so that's that was not physically possible 100 years ago. So I'm just, you know, pointing to that there's elements of this economy that we're in because of technology that lends itself to large concentrations of wealth that's in the form of a way that's not very easy or traditionally understood from our social doctrine.
And that's why these discussions are prudential discussions. You know, they're discussions that are based around principles, but they're discussions that allow us to take lots of different factors and really evolving economies, evolving situations, historical factors into account to try to come to understandings of what's best.
We need to take a break, and we'll be back with more of the Catholic Cave right after this.
Have you ever thought about joining the Catholic Church? Have you just wanted to explore the Catholic faith? All you need to do is call your local Catholic Church for more information. We are always happy to help you in your journey to discover and learn more about the Catholic faith. We have classes that are almost year-round, and the classes and information sessions do not involve making a commitment, and there is no pressure to join. Please call your local Catholic parish for more information today and start the journey of one day possibly becoming Catholic as well. God bless.
Start your weekend off right with Catholic Radio Indy's Saturday morning lineup. Join James Littleton for Forming Faithful Families at 9, followed by the pro-life message of I Choose Life at 9:30. Then enjoy today's music with a Catholic message at 10 on Catholic Jukebox Indiana. At 11 o'clock, we'll share an hour of Catholic thought and philosophy on the Catholic Cave. And at noon, it's time to grab a bite, sit back, and enjoy some food for thought with two episodes of Faith in Action. That's the Saturday morning lineup from your source for 100% Catholic programming, Catholic Radio Indy.
It makes me feel good. It makes me a joyful person.
Through you guys and the work that God does through you, it's brought joy to the people that I'm around because I'm a different person because of you guys.
Catholic Radio Indy.
Welcome back to the Catholic Cave. I'm Mark Tuttle here with Timothy O'Donnell, Kent Blanford, and we, the cavemen, have now started talking about, you know, international currency and systems of distribution. So, yeah, I think we're
pretty far outside the cave.
Part of why we have Kent with us is so that Kent can start to pull us back when we get too far afield. And I think we've reached that, haven't we, Kent?
Guys, I can't even see you far so far out.
So let's bring this back down to earth a little bit. We started off our conversation talking about this idea of universal income, the idea that, you know, governments could save money by just simply writing a check rather than providing all sorts of social services. And we started trying to peel back a little bit, talk about what some of the principles involved are to think about this, because these are ultimately prudential types of discussions. Mm-hmm. There's a wide range of quote-unquote correct answers that a good, solid Catholic can come to. We're not necessarily all going to agree, and that's probably good, as long as we're all following certain principles that are laid out by Mother Church. So one of those principles that we talked about is economics, systems of economy, etc. They should all be oriented towards the common good, and that is, you know, the idea of a flourishing community. And by flourishing, the Church warns us that to flourish really means pursuing sanctity and holiness. So, you know, there needs to be a notion of pursuing what is going to allow a community to flourish and therefore pursue holiness and sanctity. Part of that obviously involves freedom. So, you know, I think there's elements of freedom that are tied up there. Another principle that we came across, we only mentioned it, but it's a strong principle, is that of private property. You know, we as human beings, God bestows on us gifts and blessings, and those are ours to own. Those are ours to be stewards of. Those are ours to use for the benefit of other people. But the fundamental idea of being a human person is that, that we have this obligation and ability to own property. So that's another sort of fundamental principle that the Catholic Church lays out. You can't abolish the idea of private property. So the idea of absolute communism or absolute socialism, that's kind of off the table.
Correct.
And I, you know, I really don't think these ideas of universal income violate that, to be perfectly honest. Nobody's talking about taking away anybody's property or anybody's ability to use their property for their own uses.
Well, they might be. It depends on how you fund it.
I guess
because
so.
If you fund it through either taxation, right, which is a kind of confiscation of your.
Well, I don't know. I mean, certainly the church does not teach that taxation is always evil.
Well, no, I didn't say evil, but it's a confiscation.
Well, confiscation would be theft, so that would be evil.
Well, you don't have a choice in it.
Well, you got to remember.
It's not voluntary either.
You got to remember, even Jesus said, render unto Caesar what is Caesar's.
Correct.
Render to God what is God's.
Correct.
So, exactly.
Yeah.
So
but it's a leveling of where that is.
Right. And taxation, taxation ideally is used to once again help a community pay for those goods that are common. So, you know, not the common sure. good the way we were talking about, but goods like education or transportation or things that we all benefit
military,
from, that we all use,
yeah.
military defense,
yeah.
trades and tariffs with other countries or cities, whatever.
Ooh, we're going to do an episode on that coming up.
Exactly. But all of those are, you know, we pay taxes to be able to you know, basically pool our resources in theory to be able to pay for these things that we all benefit from in common.
Right. And how well that's operating, I guess that's where I was going. Because, again, the higher the tax rate, the less the individual has resources that you have to pursue the good as you understand for yourself and for your family.
Right.
And so I tend to be more in favor of lower taxes because that leaves more and not no taxes, but lower taxes so that consistent with that, the, again, principle of subsidiarity that at the local level, beginning with the family, that's where the best decisions are good. We need to have as many decisions made at that level and then, you know, up from there. So
let's talk about that a little bit because we kind of missed it and dodged it when we were talking about sort of this distribution of production. One of the principles of the church, and I would say this is a principle of the church, is that the basic unit of economy, the basic unit of economic production, according to Mother Church, is the family.
Yes.
And I think particularly in Western society, we've moved away from that quite a bit. You know, when you got talking about Zuckerberg and the corporate structure and how, you know, he owns
a lot of the family's disintegrated too.
Exactly. There's been a it's certainly not unrelated. I think the family has disintegrated because the economic opportunities that are afforded to a unit as a family have diminished over time as well. You know, it used to be you had a huge sort of economic advantage by having Ma and Pa and four strapping young youth running a farm. That gave you a huge amount of economic advantage, where now, you know, having four mouths to feed in a city where, you know, housing is expensive and it's difficult to afford schools and education, you know, now having a large family, that's become a bit more of an economic liability.
Yeah, the economics of a large family are definitely difficult, right? And take a lot of care and prudential judgment to navigate that. But you're right, though, at the most fundamental level, it's the domestic church. It's the family that we ought to. I would say if that's probably the one place we always need to kind of go back to and try to, when we think about how these different policies or things might play out, different programs, what's the effect on the family? Because how the family goes, for good or for bad, is ultimately where society is going to directionally going to go.
And that's one of my big critiques with the idea of the universal income, because most of the places it's been proposed, it has not been a family income. You know, it has not been proposed as, you know, X amount of money per family. It's based on you know, a certain distribution per individual. And I think that's going to continue the erosion of family, or at least kind of giving a little bit of an economic motive towards not forming families, towards remaining single, That sort of economic stimulus is not what a lot of these cities and a lot of these societies need.
And we're going to run out of time. I mean, that's a whole other thing. We will have to maybe bring that up in another program, Mark. But this whole idea of householding, I think, is really an important one. And you're right. Maybe we're in the situation where marriage, in some respects, in some perspectives, has been reduced to an economic arrangement, and therefore, as long as the economics are you know, sufficient, there's no reason then to get married, right?
Right, exactly, yeah. Exactly, you know, yeah.
The marriage is primarily an economic arrangement of two people helping each other, with householding. Then what's the point of getting married if we're, you know, kind of financially independent anyway?
Right.
If that's all that's going on, which it's not.
But. Yeah, I think economics affects in another way that, you know, if the purpose of life is simply economic gain,
Then
there are more efficient ways really to gain money and gain wealth than having a family. Yeah. You know, families become an inefficient model for economics.
Yeah.
And so, you know, the idea that the families really should be kind of the central economic unit of society, that goes out the window.
And that is Karl Marx.
Yeah. Yep, exactly. So, yeah, you're right. You slouched towards communism and socialism very quickly along those lines.
Well, you know, just in looking at the overall situation, guys, just an observation here is the fact that it seems like we've divested ourselves of our personal responsibility. It's a matter of many, many times, for example, with this universal income thing. Well, the government's going to give people money. What happened to taking care of our neighbor? What happened to our responsibility for making sure that the widows and the orphans are fed? It's a matter of we've handed that over to a government, we've handed that over to big organizations. And, you know, when I look at it, what it comes down to is, you know, we go back to Genesis. Am I my brother's keeper? Guess what? The answer is yes.
Yep. And, you know, Rerum Novarum, the very first social encyclical, was very, very clear about that. And one of the warnings against socialism and also against capitalism was that they're taking away some of the prerogatives of the church. The church not only has an obligation to provide for the poor, but the church has a right to provide for the poor. And it's really the church's job, not government's job and not the corporate world's job, to provide for the poor, to provide social services. And yeah, I think we've, especially in America, gone far afield from that.
I think if we take a look historically, the Christian church, when it was first being established, when it was first spreading throughout the Roman Empire, the thing that made it different was the fact that it was a grassroots operation, taking care of the widows, the orphans, and those who were in the margins. It's something that, you know, I think if we could reclaim that role in the world today, the Catholic Church could reestablish itself, Christianity could reestablish itself, and could really take over those roles and do what it was meant to do in the first place, to take care of each other.
Right, right. So, you know, these proposals of universal income, you know, is sort of the end, I guess, analysis of this. There are systems of universal income that might work, that might be consistent with Catholic thought and Catholic teaching, but I see it as unlikely. I see it as difficult to square up with all of the different principles that we've talked about on this show of keeping and promoting family, of keeping and a respect for private property, of keeping an understanding of stewardship, that our wealth is ultimately ours to be used for the service of others, and most importantly, for keeping the role of church within society, as church as the custodian and really the protector of the poor, the widow, the orphan.
Absolutely. And the dignity of work itself, work is good for us. And so with that, we're going to have to call it a show. Thank you all very much for listening to The Catholic Cave here on Catholic Radio Indy. I'm Timothy O'Donnell, still in the cave with Mark Tuttle and Ken Blanford. Until next time.
The Catholic Cave is a production of Catholic Radio Indy. Replays of this program are available in podcast form at CatholicRadioIndy.org. Comments about this program can be addressed to Kent at CatholicRadioIndy.org or by calling 317-870-8400. Did you miss something in this show or just want to hear it again? Podcasts of this and all our other great local programs are available 24/7 at CatholicRadioIndy.org.